This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today, we talk graphic design with the man behind some of Hong Kong's most famous corporate logos. Yes, yes, the H from Hong Kong Land and HSBC's hexagonal logo type. We visit Harry Steiner's first ever retrospective. Plus,
consumers, they were ready to really jump to a next stage. And Vogue China launching in China of that kind of standing and quality would probably trigger this whole new wave, new stage for fashion and luxury in China. And I was proved right.
We stay in China and sit down with Angelica Chung. She's the editor-in-chief of Vogue China. We talk about being a tastemaker and how she helped the monthly publication sell out of its initial print run and stay strong despite a digital deluge. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Like so many expats, Vienna-born graphic designer Harry Steiner moved to Hong Kong for a temporary assignment. That was in the 1960s, and he's still there. Since then, Steiner, now in his 80s, created some of the city's most famous corporate logos, from the H in Hong Kong Land to the HSBC hexagon, that could be seen outside of each of the bank branches in 66 countries around the world. Known affectionately as the father of Hong Kong design, Steiner is currently the subject of a first-ever career retrospective at the Design Society in the neighbouring city of Shenzhen. Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief James Chambers went to visit Steiner at his office in the Mid-Levels neighbourhood to chat about the latter's six decades in design.
There was no such thing as graphic design. I once met somebody at a party at that time, and he showed me his card, and he had a whole bunch of things. He did gardening, interior design, et cetera, et cetera. And he asked me what I did, and I said, I gave him my card, and it said graphic design. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, we do branding and advertising and so on." And I met him a few months later at another party, and he gave me his card, and he'd added to it graphic design.
Do you have a favorite Hong Kong icon or sign that, whether it still exists today or has sadly disappeared, but is there some iconic sign that you particularly like? You know, for me, I think it's probably quite a common one, the signs for all the pawn shops. It's quite iconic bit of Hong Kong graphic design. Is there one that you particularly like?
Well, the signs that have gone, they were largely medicinal. Po Chai Yun, Tiger Balm, Bak Fa Yao, which is white flower oil. But a lot of those signs are still around in corners of Wan Chai and so on. And the packages themselves are still here. They all have a picture of the founder on them, and they look, I think, impressive, but kind of staid. The signs themselves, we have a sign, a wooden sign that you may have noticed on the staircase coming up. It's a large, long wooden sign with letters carved into it. And I saw it initially in a car, and it was on the, not the sidewalk, but almost in the gutter. And I came back, and I was greeted with apprehension by the shop owner. And I realized afterwards, seeing a white face, he probably thought I was from government. And, because I said, that sign out there. And he said, "What about it?" And I said, "Would you mind if I took it away?" He said, yes, take it. And I said, why are you throwing this away? It's quite nice and big. And he said, because he was getting a free illuminated plastic sign from Kent Cigarettes that he could put over his shop. And this old thing, please take it away. He was hoping that the government wouldn't charge him for disposing of it.
Your exhibition at the Design Society in Shenzhen you know, spans almost six decades of your work.
Mm.
What was it like pulling all of that stuff together and actually collecting, I guess, your career in one place and looking back at your whole catalogue?
Well, as the actress said to the bishop, I'd never done this before. It's as no doubt you've seen, it's a large exhibition, and we unearthed stuff that I hadn't looked at for a long time. But it was very reassuring in that, and I say this as a very self-critical person, there was nothing there that of which I was ashamed. And I was just reassured. There were things I'd forgotten about, but they held up. So I was chuffed.
Could you look back at them and see the progression of your career? Do you think your style has evolved over that time, or do you see a similarity over the decades?
Neither. I have no style. My design is based on the project, on the needs of the client. I try to make it striking, but appropriate. And if there's one thing I'm proud of, it's that nothing looks like, you can't point it and say, oh, that's Steiner at work again. It's, I work for the client. I help him communicate, not to put my stamp on something where you can, identify who did it. And that's the kind of hairpin I am.
Perhaps one of your most famous designs is of the hexagonal red and white logo that you did for HSBC. We're sat in your office on Conduit Road in the Mid-Levels, which is on a hill in Hong Kong Island.
Right.
And from here, you can look down at the center of Hong Kong, down at the financial district, and you will be able to see the Hong Kong headquarters designed by Sir Norman Foster. And sitting above that, on the top, on the front, is your logo. How nice is it for you to, when you walk around Hong Kong, just to look up and see your work displayed in such a prominent position?
A lot of people ask me that, you must feel good. I just see it as, naturally I know I did it, but it's not as though I get palpitations every time I look at it or get teary. I just think it worked out nicely. And it has an interesting story because I worked for HSBC as a consultant for 18 years doing annual reports for them. And I, when the opportunity came up and we bid and presented for the job, I was delighted. And it's germane, but it's so well known that I think if we say HSBC, they see the symbol immediately. But it's based on the original flag of the bank. And at a time when there were still flags that the Hongs or the large companies had, and they were all based on the Cross of St. Andrew, diagonal cross, variations of it. And essentially the mark is that, except they had two red triangles and two white ones, except that I made it easier to work. I made it a square. And then, because I didn't want to draw lines around the white part, I put two more triangles on the outside. And it just fit in, and it was a very smooth process. And it was just serendipity that that time Norman Foster was finishing the building, and it just worked at the same level.
Do you think, having lived and worked in Asia for so long, that the East has had an effect on your style, on your approach, on your designs?
No, I still have the same ethos that I had at the beginning, which is, why are you doing this? Who are you doing it for? what's the best way to communicate with it. And then you put together elements that are appropriate, and appropriateness is the operative word. I don't know, maybe once I was asked to do something that looked like Steiner, and I didn't know what that was, but in general, clients have problems. Graphic design has become a profession. One of the things about those days was it was called commercial art, and a professional solves, be it a surgeon or a lawyer, you solve problems for your client, and I think that that professionalism is a mark of the big shift that happened around the time that. Not just I, but Alan Fletcher and Milton Glaser and a whole bunch of other people were going into this. That was the big shift after the war.
A lot of your corporate logos, you've designed corporate logos for a lot of big institutions.
Yes.
in Hong Kong, not least HSBC, but also Hong Kong Land, which is essentially the property developer of the Central District. Are there any secrets to designing a corporate logo that will then stand the test of time?
Yes, it should be appropriate, distinctive, and have a sense of inevitability about it. Hong Kong Land, for example, it's nice to be able to tell a client a story, you know, what this means, because they don't understand abstractions. So if you say, as in the case of Hong Kong Land, it's like the floor plan of an office building, you know, with hallways and everything, but an H-shaped building, because it's important for the client to be able to justify what he's done, and especially to explain it to his wife.
And finally, we've been talking about your long career to date and looking at your exhibition in Shenzhen. But here we are today in Hong Kong. You know, it's a Thursday morning. You're at the office. What kind of things are you working on at the moment? What are you interested in?
We're very much involved in putting together pieces from our archives for the M+ Museum, which is a museum coming up, I think opening next year, a museum of design in the area of Hong Kong, which is set aside for museums and one case in concert hall. And that's quite engrossing, and that's where I'm going down memory lane and being reassured. It's difficult. But as I said originally, I'm very pleased that I have no shame, or I'm not ashamed. There's a difference of anything I've done, no matter when. So it's been a positive experience.
That was Henry Steiner in conversation with the one, the only, James Chambers. Staying in China now, as the country's disposable income has risen steadily, so too has the nation's relationship and interest in fashion. China is no longer considered a wacky outlier or a boring backwater. No, one magazine has managed to find and steer the spending power, and that is Vogue China. Launched back in 2005, it was an instant hit, selling out of its initial print run, and has continued to stay influential despite the digital pressures at play. Angelica Chung is the magazine's editor-in-chief and a woman who helped redefine fashion magazines in China, transitioning them from hollow translations of Western fashion content to tailor-made stories that stirred the Chinese readership. Today, Vogue China continues to grow with a print readership of 2 million each month. Here's Monocle's Sydney correspondent Clarissa Sebag Montefiore talking to Chung recently.
Originally, I didn't want to take the job at the time, because I had made up my mind to go back to law, which was basically what I studied. And what changed my mind was when Condé Nast, the big boss, Jonathan Newhouse, told me that they wanted Vogue China to be one of the best Vogues in the world. because that would be suitable for China, the country that big size. That changed my mind, because for years I had been editor of Marie Claire, editor of Elle China, publisher of Be International. I wanted to leave the business because I thought they were all sort of syndication editions, secondhand materials from other editions, and I thought I had enough. So when they asked me to achieve something, I thought at the time, most people thought, was unachievable. I thought that was an interesting challenge. So I took that challenge and then started on an amazing journey that's still ongoing today.
And why was that considered unachievable? Why was China considered such a difficult market?
Well, that was 15 years ago, and not many the brands that we know today were in China. There were a few, but just a token sort of presence there. And at China at the time, we just finished this open door policy. They were expanding on the developing the economy, and they started to welcome more new interesting ideas from overseas. And it was at the verge of the whole luxury and fashion industry market taking off. And people were not that knowledgeable about fashion and luxury. And also financially, they didn't have that sort of consumption power yet to spend on them, because that was the first generation of Chinese who had the opportunity to work in order to make themselves wealthy. But they were still sort of at the process of doing that, and not quite sort of wealthy enough to say I pour out money on luxury items. But because of that, that showed opportunity, because when the market was mature, then the competition would be fierce. So a lot of the business decisions are really down to timing sometimes. So I thought that was interesting, because I could tell that as a market, you know, the population, consumers, they were ready to really jump to a next stage. And Vogue China launching in China of that kind of standing and quality would probably trigger this whole new wave, new stage for fashion and luxury in China. And I was proved right. So that's why I thought it was interesting. But at the same time, because it was non-existent in the modern sense, the talents were in short supply. Photographers, stylists, a lot of the visual talents were quite limiting. And that was the challenge, because that means that when we launched, we had to import a lot of the international talents, photographers, stylists, and have them to tailor-make content for the Chinese, whom they were not very familiar with. So that's the biggest difficulty in persuading the international talents to work for me, because we were nobody. People thought, China, oh, do you understand my art, for sophistication? And secondly, I don't know you. Thirdly, do you really need to do this? And then there's the Chinese population, the Chinese culture. Then after they agreed, the talents agreed to work for me, I had to make sure whatever they created would resonate with the Chinese audience. And on top of that, the whole thing about understanding really the hardcore fashion industry. Even though I had been editing Elle and Marie Claire and B and all that, it was different once you work for Vogue. You are in the center of the fashion industry, and you really had to understand a lot of how the business worked. So that was, I think, was when I really started to consider myself as a fashion professional. Before that, for years, I did positions. But I always thought I was a bit of like an observer looking in. I think that's what good journalists are, no? They were more objective, they collect the facts, they give views, but you didn't count yourself as a member of any actual community that you covered. But when you joined Vogue, you started working at Vogue, that's when you started to feel that, I think I am a member of the industry now. So that's the difference.
That was the editor-in-chief of Vogue China, Angelica Chung, speaking to Monocle's Sydney correspondent, Clarissa Sebag Montefiore. Thanks, Clarissa. And if, like us, you're fans of mid-century modern furniture, you'll by now know that many of the best pieces can be found in antique shops carefully sourced by their owners. We were curious to trace these eagle-eyed dealers back to their source, and for those of you based in London, it's not as far away as you might expect. Sunbury Antiques Market, known to locals and traders as Kempton after the racecourse on which it's held, is a fortnightly event that draws dealers from across the UK and Europe. The fair has grown over the past 40 years to become one of the biggest regular fixtures of its sort in the UK. The market is open to the public, but the real business goes down before the trains start, which is why a 6:30 a.m. arrival time is essential. Monocle 24's Augustin Macellari braved an early start and headed into the wilds of southwest London to bring us this report.
Two breakfast rolls.
Bacon sandwiches are on hand as Chris Lane, a dealer who sells his expertly selected range of mid-century antique furniture from a shop called Dudley Walter in East London, explains why it's so important to get here early.
There's a lot of dealers here and they're all looking for the same stuff. Mid-century drawers, sideboards, desks, chairs, your general kind of fodder. But it's so quick. All the dealers come here, they get here really early, and it's blitzed within 45 minutes to an hour. Basically, anything that's worth buying is bought.
Kempton provides an invaluable source of stock for dealers hungry for undervalued items that can be cleaned up and turned around for a profit. Chris is one such, a Kempton regular, and willing to explain how amid the intimidating scale, some 700 stalls across the market, he's able to uncover pieces fit for a discerning client base.
I kind of arrive at the same place every time, but my route around the fair changes. Most of your regular traders will be on this row closest to the racecourse edge. They're the kind of staple Kempton guys. They all have their own spot. You know exactly where they're going to be every time, week in, week out. They always have good stuff. You kind of know your guys that have the style that you're looking for, and they'll know you, and you can have a bit of a deal with them. The further you go into the fair, there's more day trippers, you know, people who are just clearing out a house, or people who also sell, have a shop, but don't generally stall out at markets, but have loads of stuff they want to get rid of. You might find bargains in there because they might not be into the same style that you are, but might have something that they bought on a whim and they're just looking to get rid of it because they haven't got the client base to shift it.
As with so much in life, success at Kempton isn't just a question of what you know. Who you know matters as well. That's not to downplay the role of expertise, however. Almost as soon as we've set off around the fair, something catches Chris's eye.
It's an unusual wood. Definitely not teak.
No, ash.
Chris is talking to another Kempton veteran, Jonathan Lowe, at his stall.
So again, a nice look, not as deep as the teak, and certainly not like the rosewood. They're the two general materials that you'd find a sideboard in for the mid-century look anyway.
Yeah.
But this has got all the look, just a lighter wood, which is rather nice.
We're looking at a mid-century sideboard, which, Jonathan tells us, rather unusually hails from Rhodesia, now, of course, Zimbabwe. Perhaps it's a stretch to say the item's provenance is given away by the unusually fine craftsmanship on the recessed handles. At a distance, their uniformity could be machine-tooled, but a closer look reveals a human quality that, to my eye at least, suggests an artisan's personal touch. At £300, though, it's quite a commitment.
Sure you can't do £250?
It's early days.
Yeah.
Got a lot of French dealers around at the moment who I know would go for between £300 and £350 for that.
Is this the sort of thing that would stand out for French dealers?
Yes. Very much so. They're very into the mid-century at the moment, and they fetch a good price on their market for, in particular, British manufacturers. And this, by extension, is a British manufacturer.
It's a sumac. It's from Afghanistan. It's a beautiful, beautiful rug. It's hand done with silk and wool.
This is Charlie from Charlie's Rugs. He's been coming to Kempton for 6 years now, selling his antique rugs and kilims, sourced from around North Africa, Iran, Anatolia, the Caucasus, and Russia.
It's turn of the 20th century, so it's late 19th century, early 20th century. It's what the young girls make as brides before they become brides to show what the future father-in-law, what they can do. Sometimes, you know, it's just family traditions, so that's the colours that are in it. As I say, it's done very, very well. Probably taken 18 months to make that. 18 months to 2 years, but it is art.
So when we're looking at it, what sets it apart for your eye?
You always distinguish an old rug by the colours of the rug. It won't be too gaudy. It'll be nice, mellow colours, and they'll have a certain brush on them. If you look at what's above it at the moment, that's what they call a torba. And that's from Turkestan. That's Afghanistan. It's by the Turkoman tribe. It's in the Sari torba. And this is what the young bridesmaids are going to have them for wedding festivals, have them hang over the doors. Nowadays, interior designers use these on the end of a bed, so they have them as bed headboards for beds. Rather than have them hanging over a door, you can have it, it's fantastic, as a double bed headboard on the wall.
Charlie's rugs are beautiful and, as he tells me, a shrewd investment. But he highlights what's really on offer at Kempton Beyond, a bargain. That is, a ready supply of passionate and knowledgeable dealers. Many use a trip here as an opportunity to either offload items or restock their bricks and mortar retail spaces. Hannah, from the old electric shop in Hay-on-Wye, is one such trader. She set off at 2100 and arrived at 1 this morning to guarantee a good spot trackside. She explains what makes the onerous trip worth it.
Here we often bring things that we haven't restored yet, so they haven't gone into the shop and perhaps we haven't got time for or the energy for, or they're too big or whatever. So things often end up here that aren't quite ready to go in the shop.
And presumably here you're also selling to a wider client base, traders and the public.
Yeah, quite often. My partner John Paul works often as an art director in films, so he will quite often sell to film buyers. We get people who are buying for films, buying for their own houses, buying for their own shops, so there's dealers buying. It's such a variety.
By happy chance, one of the film buyers Hannah describes is perusing the store next door. Tamsin Mistkowski is an assistant set decorator. She comes to every fair on the hunt for props. Amongst the sea of options, however, finding the right one isn't always a straightforward task.
There's definitely like a strong visual kind of language that everyone that's working on the film, in my department anyway, is working towards. But then when you get here, there's so much that you kind of have to just trust your eye as much. You know key pieces that you're looking for, basically, but you don't have to stick completely to that because there's so many sets that you can't keep them all in your mind at any one time, so you have to kind of be open. And if you see something that you like, even if you can't think of where it goes, my buyer would shout at me at the moment for just saying that because they think I spend too much money.
As the morning wears on, the initial energy gives way to something simultaneously busier and more sedate, the gentle perambulation of the general public. Per Chris's insight, the frenzy of the first hour dies down as private customers come in to rummage among what's left. Before leaving, there's a person I want to catch. Various traders have referred to Christian, a French dealer who sells mid-century furniture through his company Mille Chairs. Every time I head along to visit, his stall has gone unmanned for one very simple reason. He's on the hunt. Christian is one of the French dealers Jonathan spoke about earlier. The type who'd be interested in an English mid-century sideboard. He capitalises on design taste on either side of the channel to turn fairs at each end into an opportunity to sell and restock.
Normally I bring stuff I pick up in France, especially, and lots of armchairs and chairs are my specialities normally. The idea is to sell everything I bring here in Kempton and to buy some English stuff, like mid-century stuff. Like sideboards or furnitures we cannot easily find in France, so I buy those stuff here and bring them in France to sell in back.
Christian epitomises a passion for design combined with entrepreneurial spirit that itself typifies the market. The economy on display here is unique, comprised of a subset of design aficionados for whom history, materiality and patina are as important as clean lines and carefully balanced minimalist composition. Contemporary design may furnish tasteful interiors, but for some, there's nothing like the character of past use and the thrill of discovery. Amongst the textiles, ephemera, and even musical instruments, that's precisely what Sunbury Antique Market affords. For Monocle 24 at Kempton, I'm Augusta Macellari.
That was fun.
And our sincere thanks to Monocle's Augustin Macellari at Kempton Antiques Market there. And if you're in London and don't mind getting up a little early, you can head to the next edition in a week's time. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show or our brilliantly named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the magazine, which is available at all self-respecting newsstands now. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.